The Press Box is here to catch you up on the latest media stories. Hosted by Brian Curtis and David Shoemaker, these guys have the insight on the biggest stories you care about. Check out The Press Box on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Major League Baseball. A lot is going on in the world of sports right now, but don't forget the 2024 baseball season. It's officially here. Some pretty exciting things to look forward to. Can the star-studded Dodgers, can they make the World Series? Can Mookie Betts break my heart again? How about the young Orioles? How about the defending champs, the Rangers, trying to become the first back-to-back champs in over two decades? See how far they'll go. Get in on the action by visiting your local ballpark or any ballpark, or you can just go to MLB.com, tap the banner to learn more. Baseball is something else.
This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hills, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
I need support staff to clear the room.
Stand up and walk. Now.
Hello and welcome to The Watch. My name is Chris Ryan. I am an editor at TheRinger.com, and joining me on the other line, Lamentus is lovely this time of year. It's Andy Greenwald!
Chris, Lamentus 2. I was very clear when I sent you the pin in Google Space Maps. Lamentus 2.
I love the IGs you've been putting up from Lamentus 2. Andy, what's up? It's Friday morning, actually. So welcome back to the show. You missed Monday, but we had a great show with Waz. I also just wanted to quickly do housekeeping-wise. If people get a chance to check out 60 Songs That Explain the 90s, please, please do. If you haven't yet, please check it out. I went on this week and did Pavement's Gold Sounds, which is one of my favorite songs. Me and Andy both love that song. Rob's intro essay is like next level good. Rob is just doing really, really amazing work on that podcast. It's one of my favorite pods that The Ringer has done. And shout out to Justin and Isaac who work on it as well. And it's just like an incredible show. And if you have a road trip coming up this summer, I recommend you like get like five or six of them and listen to them in a row. It's like, it's a really awesome, awesome show. So please check that out. Andy, how are you?
Great. Great. I was entranced by what you were saying, you know, and it's funny. You sent me, as you were doing research, not that either of us need to do research for having opinions about Pavement, but you know, you had been reading like old spin reviews of records and stuff. And you had sent me our old editor and mentor, Charles Aaron's review of Crooked Rain, Crooked Rain. And I'd had it open in my tab for a while because I kept going back to it. Like it was just this weird, rosebud, like sled image in my mind. And then I realized that in Google Books, you can go through the whole magazine. And it was the first time I felt like maybe I grew up inside of the old time family photo booth at the Rehoboth Beach boardwalk. Yeah, like that maybe when I talk, my children, you just hear, like I'm talking about daguerreotypes and how they used to be great and you could stand for a slow exposure because this was a magazine that we like looked at and we ended up working for, you know, not too long after. And it's a wild time capsule, man. It's just a wild time capsule.
You can read on Google Books. You can, if you're
all of them.
Yeah. You can just kind of Google Pavement 1992 spin and see what where it takes you. It'll take you to some places.
Honestly, my favorite thing in it though is, you know, we especially the 90s are back in some ways in fashion. A lot of bands are taking from that style. I was listening to a great record this morning by a group called Rat Boys. I don't know if you've heard them, and it's just like I could have listened to this in 1998, and that's a compliment. I would have loved it then. I love it now. But there's just like a full page ad in Spin from like February 94 for I think Southern Comfort. Mm-hmm. And the ad is full page and it's two dudes who I guess are like, they probably did market testing. Like who are the dudes? Like who looks like a spin reader? Okay. And they both look like
Andy and Chris.
That's who I would have chosen for the ad, although we didn't know what bourbon was. I think at that point we were still, you know, pretty hooked on Honey Brown that we could pilfer from older brothers of friends. But the both guys look like Jay from Jay and Silent Bob. Like it's two J's, you know what I mean? No silence, Bob. And they are both wearing flannel shirts with nothing underneath it. And the text says, work, 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 fish. Did you see that coming?
No.
The dudes are standing on a dock holding fish they've caught.
What a world. Hey, I don't know.
What a world.
I don't know how I would connect that to the 90s.
Did that happen in 1994 more than it happened now?
Like outdoor like activities with Southern what Comfort?
Just explain to me the Venn diagram of hipster grunge dudes who read Spin magazine are shirt curious, you know, but not like committed.
Right.
Who work a lot, but when they're not working, drink bourbon and fish. Like we were one America then, I guess.
I don't think they drink fish. I think that they...
No, they drink, comma, fish.
Oh, and fish. Yeah, right. Okay. Why don't we do this? So we want to do Loki mm-hmm. and Top Chef today. But before we do, we'll do a quick bit on Joseph Adalian's mm-hmm. most recent piece on Vulture, which we often cite Joseph's work. It's quite informative. It's quite well sourced.
It's from his newsletter Buffering, which you can sign up for. We don't work for there. We're just saying it's a good, he has great sources, great reporting, and it's kind of about the streaming wars on a weekly basis.
Right. And he has a new piece that's 12 Hollywood Insiders Reveal Who's Really Winning the Streaming Wars. There are some surprises in this piece.
It's us.
Yeah, right. It's basically a list of these channels, of these streaming services ranked. And each one has a Wall Street analyst or an agent or a reality producer or a PR vet or a regular producer just talking about where they think this streaming service is at from a variety of different angles. There's some, like I said, there's some not particularly surprising information, and there's some frankly shocking information in this. Andy, what jumped out at you?
Well, I think the first thing that we need to say is all streaming data is incredibly obscure, right? Because there is no agreed upon standard of ratings. There is subscriber information, et cetera, but so much of what these streaming services mean or their successes has to be judged in terms of like internal accounting, like what they are doing for the larger corporate brand. And we are pretty blind to that information, although we can certainly make some guesses. The second thing is that everyone quoted is just a shark in a snake's body or like a snake riding a shark.
They remind me of the people like Russillo used to do these anonymous NBA scouting profiles of incoming draft classes. And like when you throw anonymous on an NBA scout, it's just like, brother, duck.
Yeah. I mean, everything here, this is the real Knives Out too, right? Everyone quoted anonymously has an agenda, and you could read this and be like, every service sucks. Everything is a disaster. And everybody's awful. And maybe that's true. This is, you and I live and work in this town. It certainly has its rough edges. But I think that it has to be taken with that grain of salt as well. You know, every single one of these services does not come out looking great. So that said, I think the biggest headline I think that you and I wanted to hit is the number one, but not necessarily with a bullet, maybe with a bunch of knives in its back, is Netflix, right? And the takeaway from what people say about it is that it is more fallible than maybe the larger watching public thinks, but also the perception of it is shifting. I think there were a couple of things that happened this week that lend credence to that as well.
There was something about the way in which the Netflix, you know, critiques or assessments were phrased that I felt like obviously I don't sell things to Netflix or work within their system at all, but it articulated something that I think some people who watch these things closely felt. And you're like, I knew that there was something. And sometimes mm-hmm. you're like, well, Netflix is just like, doesn't seem like they put out prestige shows anymore. Or maybe like, it just so much shit is on there and I never know mm-hmm. like what's new or what I want. And then the sense that there are a lot of people who I think in the line here is like, it's like credit to Netflix for becoming the Kleenex of streaming, where it's like mm-hmm. people don't refer to it streaming, they refer to it as Netflix. You know, they don't refer to it as TV, they refer to it as Netflix. Now, this week there was a lot of online kind of clamor about, I honestly can't remember the name of the show, but it's like a dating show where people dress up as animals in full animal costume, stray beasts, something
like
that.
It's called Sexy Beasts.
Sexy Beasts. Thanks, Kaya. Sorry.
Thanks, Kaya.
I don't mean this in a pejorative way, but this looks like the dumbest thing I've ever seen in my life. And this is kind of like, this is how Netflix wins. Is like, this is the kind of stuff that they're like, oh, wow, we can put losers in costumes and they can date one another. And that's way cheaper, way more effective than spending millions and millions of dollars on House of Cards.
Do you know who says Kleenex is just the catch-all for facial mm-hmm. tissue in a pejorative way? Puffs says that.
Sure, right.
Everyone else is like, give me a Kleenex.
Right.
It's pretty cool to be Kleenex, I think. Yeah. Well, no, let me rephrase that. Might not be cool.
It does.
Pretty profitable.
It's pretty profitable. Right.
There were two sort of supporting pieces of information here that I thought were interesting to come out this week. One, a reported cover story in the Hollywood Reporter. One, some vaguely sourced tweet that I'm going to refer to. So this is a perfect podcast, in other words.
Right.
One was the Kenya Barris cover story. And for people who don't know the name, Kenya Barris created Black-ish. He wrote Coming to America, among many other things. He was one of the big Netflix signings when they were doing that run of like $100 million deals with Shonda Rhimes and Ryan Murphy. Kenya Barris was the recipient of one of those deals. His first show was Black AF, which he then starred in with Rashida Jones. And then a few months ago, he consciously uncoupled from Netflix in which was sort of a shocking move, with a lot of money and a lot of years left on the table, to go become an equity partner with Viacom and BET in a new venture called BET Studios. And this thing explains all of it. And anyway, obviously this piece was with Kenya's participation and it was from his point of view in a lot of ways, but Lacey Rose is a great interviewer. The takeaway from it was he was like, Netflix wasn't the place I thought it was.
Right.
And it wasn't the place that was going to push the envelope. And of course, from Netflix's perspective, they were probably like, we wanted Black-ish. We don't want you doing your version of Curb Your Enthusiasm. So right. It was clearly a bad fit from jump. But that was another sign that, you know, Netflix is becoming the broadcast television that we thought it was going to supplant. The other piece of anecdotal evidence was this study that basically the median age subscriber of Netflix is considerably higher than any of the other services. Again, that's not a bad thing. Like older viewers.
Yeah,
are what
they
keeps...
typically have more money. I mean, like there's like a certain value. I mean, like what, like look, subscriber based businesses skew advertising. So a lot of that demographic stuff may have different uses within their kind of economic ecosystem or whatever their business plan is. I do think that there's like an element to Netflix that feels a little like private equity or like driven by purely statistical analysis and like cost and you know, it's basically like cost benefit analysis rather than it would be cool to put a show like this on, you know, like it would be cool. It would be cool. Like, why don't like, 100%. We'll do Underground Railroad. You know what I mean? Like, what does Chloe Zhao want to do? Like, she can have it. Yeah, like, give her 10 hours, you know?
I mean, I think having an older subscriber base just means that the early adopters are usually younger people who are hip to things. And then Netflix has been around so long that everyone got their parents a subscription or their parents got the subscription. And that's a really successful thing. I mean, your boy David Muir is dining well in New York still because of older people who are still watching TV.
That's right.
You know, forget about young Sheldon. What about old Sheldon? That show ran for years. So that's a great place to be. Your point, though, is really well taken and important, which is to say that we still think of Netflix, and maybe it's still relevant as they're expanding in territories around the world where they have to compete for different eyeballs and different properties. But generally, when you are successful in anything, let alone television, you do more of the same because people come to expect that from you. When you are hungry and not yet successful is when you take the biggest risks. And this is a cycle that we saw happen 10, 15 years ago. And we always cite this, but, you know, Breaking Bad and Mad Men were like top drawer scripts that everyone had read and had gotten Matt Weiner and Vince Gilligan work and jobs and interest and meetings, but had not been made. And AMC was in a position where they were the ones who were ready to take the chance. Mm-hmm. And that's generally where a lot of these other streamers are. And you can see this in the behavior of what Joe Adalian ranks, or his anonymous sources rank as the last one, which is Peacock. And, you know, I'll speak delicately because of my relationship with Universal and with the people involved
in
this transaction.
And you just are a huge fan of peacocks in general. I mean, you have many.
Anytime I go up to Pasadena, I'm like, look at that blue guy on that roof. I think it's notable that friend of a pod, Damon Lindelof, sold his new show to Peacock. That's, you know, we don't know anything about it. I think it's called Mrs. Jones. But it's interesting. That's something that probably because of his relationship with Warner Brothers was at least on Casey Bloys' desk first. I mean, that's where Watchmen was, and Peacock bid on it. And that must mean, for me, that means it's exciting. That means it's interesting. That means it's risk-taking. And so you got to pay attention to that piece of the ecosystem as well when you talk about it.
Yeah, the only other thing I would mention before we move on to Top Chef and Loki is just the Hulu assessment here is worth noting, just because I use Hulu. I mean, I know many people who use Hulu as their way of watching live television. I know people who use Hulu is primarily, it's like they're, that is actually what people refer to Netflix. Like people use Hulu for all of that stuff. But, and I actually find that I've enjoyed many Hulu originals, but the industry and the town perception of Hulu seems to be quite a bit lower than mine.
Yeah, it's odd. Also considering Hulu, you know, first streaming service to win a Best Drama Emmy for Handmaid's Tale, like by all accounts, and plus their relationship and with Neon.
Digitally distributed the Best Picture winner. Yeah.
Parasite. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And had Palm Springs, which was a big success for them.
And Nomadland.
I think a lot of that assessment was viewed, it was being attacked from two fronts. I think creatively people were saying, I think that the agents or whomever, the studio, other, you know, the creative side of it was venting some frustration, apparently, with the leadership team there in terms of the process. And I think that was speaking to the deeper divisions as to what is Hulu now, when there's remnants of Fox still there, there's Disney still there, there's the creative team that was excited about making pretty groundbreaking stuff, and there's FX, which is still now folded into Hulu. So there's a lot of cooks in that particular kitchen, and the kitchen itself might be redundant, because for the rest of the world, the Hulu content is on a Disney Plus hub. You notice I say Disney Plus when I'm speaking about the rest of the world. The French accent only applies domestically.
Sure.
Called Star. And it's not too much of a stretch to imagine that that might be Hulu's future, because Disney, you know, has multiple theme parks, but do they need multiple expensive
streaming services?
Relatively streaming services.
Yeah, I think it depends on how long they can. The bundle right now, the ESPN Plus Hulu Disney Plus bundle, I think is attractive. If that ever winds up being like, thank you for subscribing to these three different services for a while, now your bill is $35 a month or $40 a month, I think people are going to start making some decisions.
I think the last thing to say about it is, for me, the bottom line in any of these conversations is really, and yet, you know, this is not how I am in my actual life, but it is financial. And we talked about Netflix's, pleasing shareholders and using market positioning to continue to grow and have deep pockets. But we're talking about a battle in which two of the participants are the two richest companies on earth, Amazon and Apple. Mm-hmm. So they're in it. You can take shots at them and be like, oh, they disappeared Barry Jenkins' 10-hour Underground Railroad, a show that you and I are going to return to and talk about. But they can do it. So literally, so what? You know, not to Barry Jenkins or to his fans. I don't mean that disrespectfully. I just mean that Amazon and Apple aren't going to fail.
They keep
rolling. They can't.
Right.
And Disney is also uniquely positioned, both because of its content library and its enormous track, you know, its enormous head start with subscriber base because of the appeal of its properties, but also its properties. And now that cruise ships are running again and theme parks are open, it's really rich. So
that whole thing is going to just go great. It's the cruise ship thing is so smooth.
Oh, it's so smooth. Like, how excited are you to be back on the grand ballroom deck?
No, I mean, it's just great because I've always wanted to visit the Keys by large battleships.
Slowly is the key. That's how I like to get places.
Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll do Top Chef and Loki. This episode is brought to you by Mint Mobile. If you've had it with your overpriced wireless plan with its insanely high monthly bill and unexpected overages, then listen to this. For a limited time, wireless plans from Mint Mobile are $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan. That's unlimited talk, text, and data for $15 a month. Wow, right? To get this new customer offer, just go to mintmobile.com/watch. That's mintmobile.com/watch. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for more details.
Just because you wrestle alligators for a living doesn't mean you should have the skin of one. Say goodbye to dry and cracked skin with Old Spice Super Hydration Body Wash with vitamin B3. Made for 24/7 renewing moisturization with daily use. With scents of vanilla and shea, people will think you've taken up candle making as one of your hobbies. And there is nothing wrong with that. Old Spice Super Hydration Body Wash. Shop Old Spice now.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You might say all kinds of stuff when things go wrong, but these are the words you really need to remember. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. They've got options to fit your unique insurance needs, meaning you can talk to your agent to choose the coverage you need, have coverage options to protect the things you value most, File a claim right on the State Farm mobile app and even reach a real person when you need to talk to someone. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Okay, we are back. What do you want to do first?
Let's do Loki, then let's transition into the TC because it's going to get spicy.
Sure. I guess this is their, this was the Linklater one, you know? no, I mean, we busted balls about the director bullshit stuff from earlier in the season. And like, it was like, I think Before Sunrise was in there.
Right. This is literally a meet cute on a train.
And it's just two folks walking, telling each other stuff about themselves. I continue to think that this is probably the most cohesive and in some ways coherent, like, version of Marvel on Disney so far. Or Marvel on Disney Plus.
Yep.
I have to admit, I kind of don't know what the show is. I know what it's about, like, technically. I don't know what the sort of quest is here or what we're doing three episodes in. Like, I don't know and I think that's part of the sort of maybe the inherent charm and maybe problem with Loki is if he's always lying and if he's always creating sort of distractions and enchantments and mischief and all this stuff that, like, you kind of go down a lot of blind alleys with this character because you think he's something for 5 minutes and then he's something else. And when you double it by having Sylvie, you know, you're going to have a feeling of like, am I watching anything real right here? And is there some light at the end of the tunnel in terms of what these people want?
Right. Well, I mean, I hear you on that. I think that what we're building to clearly is this whole time variance authority is a sham and someone is controlling something else and there will have to be some sort of rebellion from within and all the pieces that are slowly being gathered that reveal that all of these loyal Minutemen and women who work for the TVA are themselves variants. And thus the idea of a pure timeline is fraudulent, and built into that idea is the idea that people can change. Even evil gods of mischief can write their own future and destiny. And also we can have Miles Morales be Spider-Man in 2 to 5 years. So it's all part of the larger piece.
We can have Miles Morales be Spider-Man the carrot here?
No, I just mean that we already know that the multiverse and multiple timelines is the future of the Marvel Universe.
Gotcha.
You know, I mean, your guy, Doctor Strange, I mean, he's going to be in the multiverse of madness.
No, I know. They're not hiding it.
And we know that the Spider-Man pointing at Spider-Man meme is coming to our screens in December. So that is the future, and that's okay. To me, I think we both fundamentally agree that this is working. And I think that the reasons for it are kind of like what you said. You brought it up as potentially as a, you know, it could be confusing or it could be, you know, darkness on the horizon or darkness on Lamentus. But I remain thrilled that there is no who's the power broker. You know,
yeah.
I did do a browse through the Fanosphere and it's some pretty thin gruel. You know, people are like, oh, that moon is Lamentus One, which you all remember from the Annihilation crossover of the early 2000s. And that definitely means we're doing the Abnett and Lanning Guardians of the Galaxy versus the Annihilation Wave story. And it's like, my guess is Michael Waldron was like, hey, Lou Desposito and Kevin Feige, what's a planet?
Yeah.
And
they're
like,
what planet am I allowed to use? Right.
Yeah. You know, right. And that's fun because we own the IP rights to the words Lamentus One, you know, which I actually think was a Coheed and Cambria album title, but I guess I was wrong about that. And so I love that we don't, that it's harder than I think people expected to parse here. I mean, it's still fun if people go read Annihilation or whatever Kree Skrull War that is
sure.
being referenced, that that's additive, but I don't think it's necessary. And the second piece, which I think we agree on, is that after three episodes, even this one that was, and maybe because this one was slightly different, I just think this is the most successful one they've done to date also, because
the show
it
itself,
is completely,
but not
yeah, I just think it is a,
yeah.
Yeah, the show itself, because I think this is just fully a successful project. And that sounds a little cold to say it that way, but what I mean is, or clinical, it just feels like all of the talents here, and Marvel has no trouble attracting talent, that's been established, is on the same page and pointed in the same direction. So we have these great, fun, rich performances from Tom Hiddleston and Sophia DiMartino in this episode, matched with this production design, matched with the cinematography, matched with the matchless CGI or, you know, how Unreal Engine or that's however
all,
they're doing
that's
this.
All practical effects, man. That's all in camera.
I love it. Feige was like, have you ever seen Water?
Did you guys see fucking Blade Runner? Oh my
that's
God.
That's wild. But it's all, for me, it's all working because it is just, it's self-contained and moving forward on the track, to use the train analogy.
So let me ask you this. It's like, you know, somebody who's read a lot of comics and who has kind of been rope-a-doped, I'm sure, way more times than I have when it comes to, I'm reading a run and then it turns out that the consequences of this run or the stakes of this run were essentially nothing because it was all this. If it turns out that this entire episode, which I thought was at times charming and was at times a little bit of a drag, if it turns out that this entire episode is happening inside of Loki's head because she's basically doing the same thing that she did to the Sasha Lane character, where she's creating a memory of something to then entice him to, can't even remember what he's supposed to tell her or what she needs from him. I thought she just needed that.
She needs his iPad.
Right. But does she just not know where it is? Like, what's the, I don't know what it is, right. What it is that she needs from him. Is that going to bother you? That you just spent an hour
doing
a fake dream sequence. Yeah, go ahead.
Before I answer that, let me say, I did feel emotionally connected to this episode regardless, because it reminded me very keenly of the last time I was in New York and didn't charge my phone for an entire day. You know what I mean? Like looking for a place to plug in briefly. Like, you end up at a bar and you're like, can I just plug this in over there behind the bottles of pop-off vodka?
I'm sure bartenders are so glad that that's back.
They always loved that. But to your point, I think being a comic book veteran, what a badge of honor that sounds it is, but you have to move past that, because no story you're reading matters emotionally in the larger contextual game, right? It matters just in the moment where you're reading it, where an element of a character is unlocked and there's the beautiful harmony between big, crazy written ideas and beautiful artwork. It's all going to be undone. Mm-hmm. It's fragile. And I think the best comic book writing embraces that and runs towards it. So whether this was a dream sequence now or later, like, as long as the MCU is a successful project, there will probably be other Loki variants. And when Tom Hiddleston gets tired of doing it, someone else will play the part as a variant who will now be the one we care about.
See,
right?
I hope not, because I mean, I'm sure Loki has like a lot of like wins above replacement, you know, value to the universe. But like, to me, it's like the reason to do this show is to just let him cook. Like, it's not, I need Loki to be gallivanting across timelines and like screwing things up and playing tricks on folks. Like, it's like Tom Hiddleston is incredibly charming. Clear out and let him work.
I couldn't agree more, which is why
it's like not
no
Spider-Man.
Trouble.
It's like Spider-Man, they're going to have to keep casting Spider-Man. You know what I mean? But like the Loki, I'm just like, yeah, you know, like that you can bear that one with Tom Hiddleston.
I think you are right about that. And I think that as more characters are added, it'll be interesting to see where they really strike casting gold, because and seeing those characters rise. And it is definitely driven by the movies and TV shows. You know, if you go, they finally got their acts together. If anyone listening who has stepped into a comic book store in the last year would agree with me, like, I think it took them years to figure out how to do this. But if you walked into a comic book store earlier in the year, there were perfectly positioned Scarlet Witch and Vision trade paperbacks, you know, right at the correct moment. And then suddenly Falcon or Winter Soldier, like, they have solo series.
They know what's
again.
Going on.
They didn't used to have that kind of integration, and now they do. And so I think that, you know, if Sylvie turns out to be the supervillain, the Enchantress, I would not be surprised if she's playing an important role in Jason Aaron's Thor run that's happening right now or whatever.
Uh-huh.
But all that said, I like TV episodes like this. I like episodes where people talk. I think that I think the characters were well played and talked well. And I just think that overall, I'm just impressed by the construction of the series, because this fit here. This didn't feel like a mandate, you know, where Marvel wanted this, or they wanted to introduce Lamentis, or they wanted to whatever. It was like the show is built as a series of conversations, basically, you know, and two episodes were Loki and Mobius, and now it's Loki and Sylvie. And I like talkie shows, and I like that they found a fun framework in
which
to set the conversation.
I way prefer the talkie shows to the like fight sequences in Loki and that, just in general. I'm just like, I don't need to have 10 minutes of fighting. It's fine.
I don't either, but I have to say, it's funny you mentioned that. I generally kind of tune out during mm-hmm. fight sequences and anything, but I think that Marvel method that we've heard about where they're like, come in to do what you do best and, you know, we'll storyboard the other stuff for you. I'm not saying that's what happened here, but I know that sure. they offer those services to directors and people who haven't done this sort of work. I thought the fight scenes, I mean, they're hard to stage. And
yeah, I'm not knocking
and
like the skill that goes into them nothing ever happens with those. Like they're
I thought they were well integrated.
Yeah, right.
In this particular episode of TV. Last thing we should mention just about this episode before we move on to Top Chef was that it was written by Bisha Ali. She was credited with the script and just worth noting her first appearance off screen in the Marvel Cinematic Universe because she is the head writer and I guess de facto showrunner of Ms. Marvel, which has been filming cool. for these last few months, which is a big project coming up later in the year.
We should also mention that Loki is revealed to be, I believe, gender fluid and bisexual.
Yes. Well, confirmed to be.
Confirmed.
That is a big fan energy on that one. And also, I think has been borne out in the comic books in recent years.
I would love to comment on this, but I cannot think of a more profound statement than what Van and Charles did on Midnight Boys, where they discussed whether or not they would want to sleep with their identical other or their soul partner. Like if they met themselves, would they sleep with themselves? You should just listen to Midnight Boys. I don't think
I got
and I can do better.
I got nothing.
Okay, so Top Chef, the semifinal, or at least the semi. I would like to cede my time to someone else here, but not okay. you. Not you.
No.
I would like to cede my time to a man we mostly know from ESPN, First Take, and his name is Stephen A. Chef. You ready?
Wow.
Andy Greenwald, what we saw last night on Top Chef Portland was a disgrace.
Oh my God. Oh my God.
Is the show called Chef Andy Greenwald? Are we calling it just Chef? Is it just Who Wants to Cook? Or is it called Top Chef? Is it a competition anymore?
Wow. So you feel like they made it to the...
That's my. That's the.
And they blinked.
I needed to have a little bit of a remove, like by doing some character work there, because I think I'm like 65 to 75% agree with the take I just said. So it's like
okay. There's
a part of me that thinks it's beautiful what happened last night on Top Chef. So in case anybody just listens to these recaps without actually watching the show, it was the semifinal between Gabe, Dawn, and Shota. They did a quick fire where they went clam digging with Brooke. Seemed really fun. Shota cut his hand while making a soup. What did Shota make? A dashi?
He's the only one who didn't make a soup. No, he made like clam three ways. Like,
oh, that's right.
They were sake stewed, and also there was a fried element.
And then Gabe and Dawn made some soups, and everybody seemed to have a hard time getting their induction burner working in a rainstorm. But you know, everybody goes on to the final elimination challenge or the elimination challenge. It's the semifinal. See who goes to the final. It is a Dungeness crab. Forward mm-hmm. challenge where they go off and they catch their own crabs. They come back and they're supposed to cook crabs with two different preparations, a cold and a hot. And it looks like everybody makes some dynamite food, no doubt about it. And I thought that it was like the perfect distillation of where each one of those chefs are and who they are. Like Shota made like a purely creative, inventive, technically miraculous bite of food with the daikon, I thought. It looked like mm-hmm. at least. Dawn had just so much heart and soul poured into her crab boil. Mm-hmm. Gabe doing this stuff with tortillas and like trying to do different like flourishes and elevations of core Mexican preparations. And then we get to the end mm-hmm. and there's several things that are being debated by up to 12 different chefs.
Yeah.
In the judges' table. Not the judges' table, but the eating table. And then they go to a final judges' table. They award Shota wins the elimination challenge. Mm-hmm. And then they say, we've decided nobody is going home.
Yeah.
Congratulations, you're all going to the finale.
Yep.
I take it you're a fan of this decision.
I hear your frustrations.
My frustration is just that this is the second time this has happened this season in some ways, in a way. The Byron Gauntlet of the tofu tournament, and then four last chance kitchen cooks. And interestingly enough, the people who he was cooking against in Last Chance Kitchen were like, we are making it our mission so that he does not come back, because it's easier to beat four other people than five other people.
Yeah.
So I was very surprised. Not that they're like, I expect Shota to be magnanimous and he obviously loves these people that he's cooking with. I was surprised to see Shota be like, so now I have to beat two people in the finale.
Well, you mean that he wasn't expressing more?
Yeah, that there was not like a kind of like, huh, so I won this, but I actually didn't get any kind of like advantage for winning it, or there's no benefit to winning it.
Yeah, I think that's the strongest argument against this by far. And I'd be curious how the edit was handled, because Shota is not, I mean, as we saw with his attempts, good-natured attempts to block Gabe from ever winning a quickfire.
And good, and Shota wanted didn't want part of Byron coming back.
Right. Shota is competitive, and he sometimes will do the thing where you say what you really feel and then shrug it off with a good-natured laugh. So it's very possible that he expressed some of that, and maybe we'll see some of it and it was edited out, or we'll see it next week. I think one of the counters to your well-made point is that both of these things
Stephen
have happened
A's
before.
Well-made point.
Like, right. I would not go toe-to-toe with Stephen A.
Stephen A. Chef?
On any topic. What about who does Sterling sharpen your knives? Is that going to work?
Yes,
I can do better.
Max Thomas Kellerman.
Oh, I like that one. Yeah. That's a little took me a second. You understand what I'm doing right now is trying to skip bay leaf. Like I can't. This is all off the dome, guys. This is harder than it looks. These things have both happened before. The Last Chance Kitchen Gauntlet, which I was very frustrated by as well, happened last year in the All-Star season. Kevin was able to win and got back into the competition. The we can't decide, you guys are all champions, we're going to have a three-person finale, has happened before. I did not have a moment to research which seasons that happened in, but it has happened to the degree where...
I think I remember it too.
Even 2 weeks ago, I suggested that we were headed there, that there was going to be a week where no one was going to go home. Partly because of the good vibes and the sort of equal Shota is clearly separated himself, but Gabe and Don are certainly able to cook at his level and felt very, very equal in terms of their what happened last night. So these things have happened before. I also can definitely empathize with the judges, which is I want to see all three of these chefs cook the meal of their lives without restrictions. There is nothing to me that suggests that they shouldn't have that opportunity. I know the game is the game, but the game is also mutable and changes week to week and season to season. I also think that the decision may have something to do with the fact that this penultimate challenge was too hard. I think it may have just been too hard.
But that was
and
never
I
mentioned.
No, but we certainly heard from the chefs themselves being like, cooking 13 plates of food, no, 26 plates of food, two courses, while also cleaning and processing these impossible crabs is, you know, it's just not really precedented. And we saw the effects on, like, Shota never gets rattled by time or anything.
Right, and he was supposed to do sushi two ways and just did it one. Right.
Exactly. And which, by the way, never overpromise and underdeliver. Like,
I know.
You just never tell the menu person what you should just say sushi and then be like, great, sushi.
Right.
But then, you know, Dawn had an error as well, which she just bewilderingly owned up to. That was kind of interesting. She didn't need to do that. She's just almost radically honest when they were like, was this mess intentional? She should have been like, yes.
Right.
Richard Blaze would have been like, yes. And also, the sauce is so pure, you don't need anything to dunk into it.
Right, you don't need a starch, right.
I love Dawn as a person for being so honest and like using that as an opportunity to get feedback and be honest and talk about it, because I think she's going to emerge more successful. I mean, she's already a success, but an even greater chef in person. But, and then Gabe also, you know, like melted a kitchen towel into a tortilla. It's an interesting balance. I mean, they respect these chefs a lot, and obviously they want the competition to get harder and harder, but the cheese challenge and this one felt technically more demanding. And listen, people who have watched seasons or done a whole deep dive or rewatch more recently than I have can probably correct me if I'm wrong here, but they felt just really hard at a time in a technical way, like just processing crabs, you know what I mean? Like making two dishes and defeating these two people is hard enough, but doing that kind of kitchen grunt work felt really challenging. So I felt like in some ways, though they didn't say it, it was a make good because they all kind of messed up to a degree. I could see that. The other thing is, one of the successes of Top Chef has been its ability to consistently communicate to us things that are impossible for us to truly understand or reason with. You know, like this tastes better than that. This is harder than that. I completely agree with you.
And I do think that right now, and while I am enjoying the cast of thousands that they have eating and judging and talking about this stuff, there was like a real, like, you guys are shattering the glass right now moment when there is this debate about a sunchoke in Gabe's dish.
The prominence of a roasted sunchoke
and whether
flavor.
Or not the sunchoke overshadowed the crab.
Have you ever seen Brooke that upset?
No, but like, here's the issue is I don't know. You know what I mean? I'm not eating that sunchoke. I'm not eating that crab. It's one thing if there's three fishermen from the crab boat and a person who is the preserver of all crab recipes in the Pacific Northwest and somebody from the James Beard Foundation. And they're all like, well, this is just dynamite food. And then Padma, Gail, Tom, and if they have a guest judge or whoever are like, didn't like this, love this, didn't like this, love this. When you've got 12, 15 world famous chefs having literal, like, the sunchoke or not to sunchoke debates, I have no idea. And it actually winds up unwinding the kind of, not faith that you have in the sort of process, but it's not that I need Padma, Gail, and Tom to judge every dish, but I do think that they should be the voices that we're hearing. Because otherwise, you start to get into, well, fuck it. If all of Top Chef has told me that plating is important, but then Dawn dumps a bunch of stew basically in a plate and throws it on the table, and they're all like, this is fucking amazing. And a couple of people are like, this looks like she poured it in with a fire hose. Which one's right?
Top Chef, though, is a living, breathing thing. And actually, it is an 18 season march from an objective standard in the kitchen to a subjective standard, which is where we are headed, you know, where we've headed culturally, societally. I mean, it's a much deeper issue as well. I think that Top Chef has managed that march beautifully and in ways that are like deeply moving and deeply inspiring. But it is, it's not without its bumps along the road. And so if you consider it, you have two things to consider. One, Shota's triumphs this season are really incredible because he is, as he keeps saying, as he's becoming more comfortable saying and expressing, cooking purely Japanese food at this point. You know, a stewed daikon radish, it doesn't get more purely Japanese than that. And it's beautiful and transcendent. And he's competing only against himself at this point because he's not using oils. He's not using butter. You know, he's not using anything that Top Chef winners would have used. So that's in and of itself is noteworthy and amazing. One step further, though, Gabe's errors, such as they were technical.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he served a hot dish instead of a cold dish.
Right.
Previous seasons of Top Chef, I feel like that's
a Brian Voltaggio, you are going home.
Kind of, yeah.
Yeah.
Then he missed one of the most important elements on one of the plates. I personally bet
that crab tortilla would taste good even if it had some melted linen in there.
I would have been fine with it.
Mine has notes of linen, like fresh laundry.
Do you know what would taste better than sunchokes? Melted kitchen towel in crab fat. Dawn, on the other hand, though, is... she's confounding and beguiling and inspiring in equal measure, right? Because what she served them as the crab boil, her first, I loved what they said about her first dish, that it, what Tom said, that it's a branding, she made a massive branding error.
Yeah.
If she just said this was like essentially like a vegan chowder, she would make money off of it. Instead, she's like, it's a cashew soup with this on the side and with extra frizzy bits. It's like, oh, that kind of thing. When Tom jumps in and says that from like the God level chef of like how we're going to succeed in this industry that we're going to rebuild together, it's fascinating. But her second dish, this crab boil, is 10 seasons ago, you're not making that in the semifinals. Mm-hmm. You're not certainly not advancing with it. But I loved what Gail said. They all fell silent and then they were having fun and wiping each other's faces and ruining their wardrobe, you know, and that is
that you're
powerful.
Absolutely right. It's totally the transformation that not only Top Chef has had, but the difference between like we're going out to dinner 10 years ago or 15 years ago or whatever it is to now is the transformation you're talking about. It's white tablecloth and everybody is like, the chef will now dominate you with his vision of the nine course whatever, versus like, hey, you know what everybody loves to do is sit around a table and share food and share an experience together.
And laugh.
So like roll your fucking sleeves up and put a bib on, you know? And that's what Alice Waters said. Whenever James Beard was really into something, he would tuck a napkin into his collar.
And this is how smart the show is on numerous levels, right? Like the James Beard Awards are given and they're, you know, and talked about on the show, but they had become, and they were, you know, they took a year off because they'd become riven with the same kind of elitist, patriarchal, classist, you know, structures that have ruined much of America, let alone the dining scene.
Right.
And James Beard, as his biographer said recently, would have hated that because he had many problems and faults, but he did believe what Tom said in this democratization of food and food cultures. And so Dawn championed that. And so for me, allowing them both to move on, not only is going to make a really fascinating and I think just beautiful final for what has been an incredibly, incredibly successful season of TV. And we'll talk more about it next week when we get there. But I think it was fair for this moment, this inflection moment, really, for what the show is and what it's going to be. And to let these three completely distinct chefs with distinct foodways and cultural backgrounds and stories keep cooking for this familial group, as you said, of people that we also know and love. I don't know. I mean, we'll talk more about it next week. Hopefully we could have some special guests on when the season is over. But I keep using this word, and I never thought I would use it about Top Chef, but maybe I wouldn't have used it about food in general 15 years ago. But like Nina Compton and Kwame, like being the judges for this, for the diverse cheftessens that are there and the celebration that it is engendering, you know, is not like anything else I've seen on TV in a while. And it's really uplifting and pure in a way that I needed. And I think hopefully viewers have responded to as well.
I just want, is we can keep doing this where it's just like, you know what, this has really been a hard season and this has been, everybody's working as hard as they can and this is such a sacrifice and I agree with all of it and it is really heartwarming. It better end with Tom being like, finish him. Like Mortal Kombat style. That's Dawn's final test. It's like just fucking sub-zeroing somebody.
Well, just all the skills she learned cracking those giant gooey duck clams, right?
Yeah.
Like, I just hope he doesn't deliver it in a soggy fedora. You know what I mean? Like, I want him to be just a little bit more tuned up.
Okay, so we'll be back Monday, yes? You'll be joining me on Monday? Well, who knows, you know?
I love podcasting with you, my brother.
No, we'll be back on Monday. We'll kick it. And then on Thursday night, Friday morning, we'll have Top Chef, the finale, and Loki season episode 4. All right, thanks for listening, guys.
Have a great weekend, Francis.